This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, February 15th, 2021. This hour, we'll delve into the world of conspiracy theories. Ryan Neville Shepherd will deliver a preview lecture of his University of Arkansas Honors College Signature Seminar about that subject tomorrow evening on Zoom, and we'll talk to him in our second half hour. After our show, stay with 91.3 for Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today, reactions to the impeachment acquittal, and a new podcast looks at the life and music of Selena, who was more than just a singer for many in the Mexican-American community. Here and Now begins at 1, right after Ozarks at Large. A frigid blast of winter weather is affecting almost everything in the region and the state today. The National Weather Service's wind chill warning for our listening area continues through tomorrow morning, and another winter storm watch that could bring 4 to 10 inches of more snow is in effect for Tuesday night through Wednesday night. Lows tonight in northwest Arkansas, actual lows, could drop to 10 below zero, with wind chills of about 22 below zero. In the Arkansas River Valley tonight, lows dropping to about 3 below zero, wind chills as cold as 13 below. And not much relief tomorrow with highs in the lower 20s throughout the region, wind chills anywhere from 1 below to about 22 below zero. Utilities including SWEPCO, Entergy Arkansas, Ozark Electric, and Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas are requesting customers to conserve energy during the extreme winter weather, limiting use of non-essential electricity and appliances that include electric water heaters, clothes dryers, and dishwashers, as well as turning heat thermostats to lower settings, can help prevent power outages. Due to the extreme cold and the unusually high requirement for electricity, electric utilities across Arkansas and surrounding states have reached a point where electricity demand has nearly exceeded capacity. Utilities say voluntary cooperation is essential. If voluntary reductions are not sufficient to maintain continuity of service, it may be necessary to begin interruption of electric services to specific areas for limited time periods. Cooperative representatives are also directly contacting large and commercial users, asking for their cooperation as well. For more information, contact your utility providers. Just more than 1,400 new cases of COVID-19 reported by the Arkansas Department of Health this weekend. The Saturday and Sunday numbers include a total of 53 more deaths from the virus. Hospitalizations because of coronavirus in Arkansas fell by 43 patients this weekend. The number of active cases in the state nearly 600 fewer than on Friday afternoon. Governor Asa Hutchinson tweeted yesterday that the inclement weather will have an effect on vaccinations, and he asked people with appointments that can make their scheduled vaccinations safely to try to do so. This is Ozarks at Large. Since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic in Arkansas, reporters for an online publication called Facing South have been covering the poultry industry's response to the virus inside its plants, which employ hundreds of thousands of people. The news magazine is part of the Institute for Southern Studies based out of Durham, North Carolina. It focuses on investigative reporting and in-depth analysis of trends across the South. The Institute for Southern Studies, meanwhile, is a nonprofit research and media center founded in 1970 by veterans of the Civil Rights Movement. Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek recently spoke with reporter Olivia Pascal about her most recent report, which examines email exchanges between Tyson Food executives and the mayor of Springdale.
You've been doing a lot of reporting in Arkansas during the pandemic. Can you talk about the kind of coverage you've done in this state over the last few months?
So I actually moved. I'm from Rogers. I grew up there. I was in Durham at the beginning of the pandemic where Facing South is based. But I moved back here semi-permanently in the spring, but really in June to cover the poultry industry here. Really focus in on that, on coverage of the industry, because I saw a gap that kind of needed to be filled there. And so for the past several months, I've really just been trying to, I have the privilege of being able to kind of dig in really deep on stories. I don't have to publish every week or anything like that. So I've been just trying to dig in as deep into these stories as I can, turn up documents, interview people that maybe haven't been talked to, and try to provide as deep of a picture, as accurate of a picture as I can of how workers specifically in poultry plants in Arkansas, which, as you know, employ just a ton of people here, have been impacted by the pandemic, and in what ways, you know, their employers or the state and local government could make their lives easier or protect them.
I wanted to specifically talk to you about your most recent article, which was published on February 5th. It's titled "Emails Show Tyson's Sway Over Arkansas Mayor During COVID Surge in Plants." The piece details emails you obtained through a Freedom of Information Act. What was that process like?
Back in, I think it was July, August, last summer at some point, I think the final count was like 33 or something, public records requests with cities and counties, and some like executive, like state agencies, basically asking for any like internal email communications that mentioned COVID or the poultry industry or like this set of companies. And I sent those to any city or county that has a poultry plant in it in the state. Some counties were more responsive than others. Some counties had a lot more turned up than others. And actually, the bulk of what I found is in a larger investigation that was published last August that goes a little more in depth on what was happening at the time and sort of tried to take like more of a bird's eye view of the outbreaks in poultry plants in the state. I felt bad for the Spring Hill city attorney. He had just like so many emails to go through for me, and I got the last sort of dump of those emails. I went and picked it up, I guess, like late last year, the beginning of this year, just a few weeks ago. And that's where I found the emails that are in this week's article. But I would note also that my August investigation found similar emails, although not quite as blatant, but similar emails between the Rogers mayor and Tyson.
So what did you find in the emails you received from the Springdale mayor's office that your article focuses on?
Yeah, so sort of two separate things, I would say. So there's sort of two parts to this story. One is that it's sort of an inside look at how Tyson's communications and PR team were thinking about, all this media coverage they were getting of outbreaks in their plants, trying to sort of salvage the company's image in some way, and how they were interacting with local officials in places where, you know, in Rogers and Springdale, both you have huge Tyson plants, hundreds of people employed, or if not actually thousands of people employed in these Tyson plants, right? And it's a huge amount of the constituency in both Rogers and Springdale. So what you see in these emails that I have found from the Rogers and Springdale mayors, and I'm sure there's others that I just haven't, you know, seen. I'm sure this is a standard practice. Basically, the Rogers and Springdale mayors in April, the end of April, go on a tour along with some Democratic elected state officials, the CEO of Tyson, some other folks go on a tour of the chicken plant in Rogers. And it's supposed to be, you know, they're showing off all the safety measures that Tyson has implemented, you know, it's temperature scans and these little like plastic partitions on the line when workers are shoulder to shoulder and sort of all of these things that you've seen them say in their press releases. And after the tour, Jeff Wood, who's the director of state and local government affairs for Tyson, reaches out to Mayor Hines and Mayor Sprouse and is basically like, I think there is something happening on the back end where Hines and Sprouse had said, can you just like write something for me and then Wood can attribute it to me in the press release. So they send over these quotes that in Mayor Sprouse's case were drafted by, you know, Tyson says it's based on statements that the mayor had made to like media and Tyson representatives and other people at some point. But this strategic communications firm based in, whose partner was based in New York City is actually the one who drafted this quote and sends it to Tyson's PR, who sends it to Mayor Sprouse, who says, okay, great, you can attribute this to me. And then what you see is a couple days later, the week of June 11th, Tyson announces the results of mass testing in its Rogers and Springdale facilities. And in the case of the Springdale Ferry Street plant, almost a quarter of that plant's workforce is positive for COVID-19. But in that press release, you have a quote from, you know, Mayor Sprouse. It's basically like Tyson Foods is integral to our region. We are so happy that they're, you know, helping keep us, our community safe. And we love that they're testing, and, you know, sort of this, you know, canned quote that is, it helps Tyson's image, which is what it was meant to do because it was drafted by Tyson's PR people. And you see a similar thing with Mayor Hines' quote in a different press release. It's kind of the same vibe, and it goes through the same kind of channel and then ends up in a Tyson press release. So that's kind of what you see happening.
That's one part. And the other part is another set of emails that had to do with the Springdale mayor getting asked to go on CNN to talk about what's happening in his city. What did you find in emails concerning that subject in particular?
Yeah, so I don't really know what precipitated this email, because Mayor Sprouse did not respond to three emails that I sent him asking him to elaborate. But there's an email in the public records that I got, which basically shows a producer from Wolf Blitzer's show, you know, emailing Mayor Sprouse and saying the Fayetteville Springdale metro area is leading the nation in number. It's like, I think it's COVID, the rate of new COVID cases. And would you come and talk about this? And it what seems like happened from the further emails that you see is that Mayor Sprouse asked Jeff Wood, the director of state and local government affairs at Tyson, for his thoughts on the appearance, sort of thinking that, you know, Tyson would come up at some point because Tyson is headquartered in Springdale. And obviously this is when we had started to hear some media reports about major outbreaks at poultry plants, including Tyson's. And Jeff Wood sends this email to Mayor Sprouse. The subject line is background information you requested, I believe. And he basically, you know, he runs through some of the Tyson's key talking points. And then he says, a mayor in North Carolina was set to go on CNN recently, and they canceled his interview because he was so positive, which I, who knows? Like, I don't know if that is true. So he says that. And then he says, you know, they might put you on a panel with Mago Iliacoli, who, as listeners might know, is the lead organizer of Enseremos, which is a workers' justice, workers' safety advocacy organization based in Springdale. And he says, you know, she's a radical union organizer. She's been calling national media to try to create drama and controversial footage, and she has no interest in facts and will just shout and make baseless accusations, which is quite strong language. And also, you know, when you talk to Magali, she will deny all of that, any of that is true. But it sort of shows you how they are viewing this local organization that, you know, is based in Springdale, and was at the time trying to draw some attention to safety conditions in plants.
And obviously there's nothing illegal about these exchanges. So why is this something you felt was important to report?
I think it's just really important for people to understand that when you're seeing communications from local officials or from Tyson, you know, there's a lot of engineering that goes on behind the scenes of those. You're not getting just like straight unfiltered stuff. You're getting something that's gone through a lot of editing. You're getting stuff, you know, you're getting the product of all these behind the scenes emails. I also think that Tyson has a level of dominance in the agriculture industry, you know, as one of the top four meat producers in the country, but also just a level of power in this region of Arkansas because they're a huge corporation and employ, you know, thousands of people here. And I think it's just good to know that what their viewpoint is and where their interests are so that people can make decisions for themselves, you know, and think critically about statements that are made publicly. I think that's huge.
As you mentioned earlier, you reached out to the Springdale mayor, Mayor Doug Sprouse, for comment. You also reached out to Tyson. What, if anything, did they say in response to your reporting?
Yeah, so Tyson responded. I sent them a pretty detailed list of questions, and they responded to some of them and did not respond to others. They said that they sat down with Magali and had some concerns about the way that she represented safety concerns in the industry, which is, I would also say, sort of one of the more, from their PR team, is one of the more critical statements I've ever gotten from them. They're usually pretty like, oh, workers can come talk to us if they're scared. So they said that in terms of the, you know, the quotes from Mayor Sprouse that their PR team was involved in drafting, they said that, as they said with Mayor Hines, you know, this is based off of conversations that the mayor's had with Tyson and the media, and sort of that they cobbled it together from sentiments that they had already expressed publicly. The emails are linked in the article, and people can determine for themselves whether they think that's accurate. I reached out to Mayor Sprouse, to him twice, and then to another member of his team twice or once. And I never heard anything. I reached out to him and was like, did he even get the email? So I reached out again and was like, I just want to make sure you got the email. Nothing happened. Didn't get a bounce back. Reached out to the person who's labeled on the city's website as their PR coordinator, and didn't hear back. So
what do you want people to think about as they're reading your reporting or somebody else's reporting on this subject?
Yeah, I think one of the things I have tried to keep in mind in my own coverage and also just highlight in my own coverage is that the big companies, so, you know, Tyson, Smithfield, JBS, which we don't really have those here, but like Pilgrim's Pride, Georges to an extent, they all have funds for communication. They have PR teams. They have organizations, industry organizations that, you know, work with lawmakers at every level. They have all of these organizations that are working behind the scenes, and they have the money. They can fund these things. Workers groups, worker safety advocacy groups, the very few unions that exist in the poultry industry don't have that same level of resources. And so you're getting a different, when you're hearing from different groups, you're getting different levels of authenticity is how I would put it. And you're really dealing with a major imbalance of power and access. You know, Tyson CEO, as we saw last April, had a direct line to the President of the United States. Workers' justice groups at the time did not have that. That might be different now. It's not totally clear, but that is, you know, a power imbalance that has had very real consequences.
Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Olivia Pascal, a reporter for Facing South, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek about her most recent investigative report examining the poultry industry's response to the pandemic. You can find all of her reporting by going to facingsouth.org.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Kiva NWA Hub is a local, community-based lending program and a branch of Kiva US. This program expands access to microloans, which help entrepreneurs in Northwest Arkansas develop and thrive. These non-conventional loans are for disadvantaged area business owners and sole proprietors. Applicants and lenders interested in supporting area business borrowers can learn more at kiva-nwa.org.
So I flew into Langamack Bay, landed there, and got them all aboard the tender, and they took care of me. Nobody died, so I understand that. And that was the last I saw them. Flew back to Samurai then and landed myself, and that was it. Really didn't hear anything. I never thought anything about a Medal of Honor.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me on the phone is Randy Dixon with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy, whose voice did we just hear to start this week's Pryor Center profile?
That was none other than Nathan Gordon, who was our 10th lieutenant governor. I'm staying with the theme of lieutenant governors. You know, we did the last 3 weeks, and after we did Joe Purcell, I got a phone call from my old boss, Jim Pitcock, and he said, you really need to do Nathan Gordon. And I said, I'm not really that familiar with Nathan Gordon. And he said, well, it's not his time as attorney general. It was, or lieutenant governor. It was before that. He was a Navy pilot, big war hero in the South Pacific, and won the Medal of Honor. And Morrilton native. And I started looking into his life, and it was pretty astounding. And you know, there's very little audio with him because it was all silent film back then, but that's the only sound we have. But I found some other people who could speak for him and tell his story. Before we do that, could I make a correction?
Sure. Absolutely.
Well, last week we did the segment on Joe Purcell. And at the end of the program, I had mentioned that he ran for governor in 82 against Bill Clinton and Jim Guy Tucker.
Right.
And I incorrectly said that he had been edged out by Jim Guy Tucker in the runoff, when in fact he was in the runoff with Bill Clinton. And I found that out because his daughter, Edie Hoag, was listening, and she called, and it wasn't to complain. She just wanted to make sure I didn't have bad information. And I said, well, I'll make a correction. And she said, well, that's really not necessary, but we need to do that. I misspoke.
Well, Ms. Hoag, thank you so much for listening and for calling Randy and correcting us. And, you know, we extend that. If anybody hears something that we don't have correct, just let us know.
Please.
Now, you mentioned that the audio we've already heard of Nathan Gordon is the only audio we have, but you lined up some pretty good sources to tell us more about this figure in Arkansas history.
Well, best of all, his nephew, Alan Gordon of Morrilton. He was from Morrilton as well, and they were law partners. And he's heard his war stories firsthand. And I talked to him the other day, and the backstory is that Nathan Gordon was a Navy pilot and flew what was called a Catalina PBY, which they also called a flying boat. It was originally a patrol bomber, but it was later used as a rescue plane. And so he was stationed in the South Pacific, and whenever a bomber or any other pilots and planes and their crews were shot down in the water, he would go out and rescue them. And you know, you would fight not only gunfire from the enemy, but the weather and choppy seas and that sort of thing. And so I had a nice conversation with his nephew, Alan Gordon, and he tells the story of the mission that brought his uncle to the Medal of Honor.
They got called in on this particular day that there was a plane down that was in a battle, offshore battle, and they were taking shore fire, and then they'd been shot down. There's some pilots that were in life rafts, and they had been called in to make rescue, and which they came in and were able to land once and pick up some of the crew, and it was real rough seas at the time. Nathan would tell the story. I mean, one thing about those planes, they were hard to land when you had high waves, and a lot of times if the engines got wet from salt water, they were hard to restart. So they tried to keep one engine going all the time, and they had some trouble getting the first life raft on, the guys from that life raft, and they finally able to get them aboard and took off, and they got another call. Another plane had been shot down, and there were some others, and another life raft that were taking fire from the Japanese shore batteries. They came in and made a second rescue and had a lot even more trouble trying to get the some of them were wounded, some of them gravely wounded. Got them on board and were able to get the plane off second time. And then they got a third call, and each one was in closer to the shore guns, and so this was going to be a pretty dicey landing. And he told the crew, he said, you know, if we go in, chances are we're not coming out. This is going to be a hit and miss deal. And the crew, to a person, said, "We can't leave those guys behind. Let's go try to rescue them." And that's the reason he said, you know, the whole crew should have gotten the medal along with him. But they were able to get in the last time, and at that point they had 18 people on board that they had rescued. There were six more in that raft. And they were able to get them aboard finally. They had to kill both engines, and he said, you know, we probably don't get this engine started, and they finally got them started. They took some fire also. I mean, their plane was catching some flak. And they got those final six aboard and got them out.
That is Alan Gordon talking about his uncle, Nathan Gordon. Nathan Gordon, the subject of this week's Pryor Center Profile. I'm talking with Randy Dixon. What a story.
Oh, an amazing story. And he was 27 years old when that happened. So he's already quite an accomplished and has had quite a life before he's 30 years old.
Then he does come back to Arkansas and is part of something I had never heard this term before. I listened to these archives that you sent me before our conversation, Randy. Ernie Dumas, who is himself an Arkansas legend as far as I'm concerned, Ernie Dumas talking
absolutely
about the GI revolt.
Yes. Right after the war, Gordon returns to Arkansas like many other soldiers, and they decided, many of them, to run for office. And Ernie Dumas covered Gordon in his last two terms in the 60s, and he talks about this GI revolt.
Back at the time, this was during the immediately after World War II, you had the kind of the GI revolt, and you had Sid McMath and a whole bunch of others, well, Max Howell from Little Rock and others, coming back from the war and running for public office to kind of, they had fought for democracy over there and came back supposedly and said, well, here we got all this corruption and undemocratic system back home, and so they all ran for public office, and Nathan Gordon was one of those, but he didn't want to be. He was apparently encouraged, you got to run for public office. And so he said, well, I'll run for lieutenant governor because it's a part-time job and I don't have time to do all that stuff. So that's what he did.
And so he served under, you know, like I said, four governors. It was Benjamin Laney, and then you saw or heard there Sid McMath, and then Francis Cherry, and then the final was Orville Faubus. So he was in office for 20 years, and from 47 to 67, and he was a very, you know, for a guy who was a war hero, he was very, very unassuming, and Ernie Dumas talks a little bit about that.
During those years in the 60s, the late 50s and the 60s, was the period of great tumult in Arkansas, as you know, after the Brown decision in 1954, integrating the schools, and then the Little Rock school crisis in 1957, that dominated everything. And every politician of any note had to take some side in all of that in some way, from all of our members of Congress and members of the legislature. And rarely was there anybody who was not on the side of Orville Faubus and the segregationists, except Nathan Gordon. And I don't know that he ever did anything or said anything to show any sympathy for the segregationist side of that issue. He was kind of describing himself later as he was a Democrat. He was not a Dixiecrat, but he was a Democrat.
That's Ernie Dumas talking about Nathan Gordon, who was lieutenant governor for 20 years in Arkansas. But as we're going to hear Steve Barnes tell you, he wasn't power hungry.
No, it was a part-time job, and that's what he considered it, and that's how he treated it. And you know, his time at the Capitol was actually limited. You know, the legislature met once every 2 years, and Steve Barnes covered him in his final years. And this is what he had to say about him as lieutenant governor.
My overriding impression of Governor Gordon was that he was a fairly uncomplicated man. He came to the Capitol. He did the job of lieutenant governor during a legislative session, and then he went home. To my knowledge, he never had a staff, maybe a little bit of secretarial assistance during legislative sessions. But if the legislature was not in session, he was back in Marlton practicing law. It was not a full-time job, as some recent lieutenant governors have made it.
Steve Barnes talking about Nathan Gordon, who is lieutenant governor of Arkansas. We're talking about Nathan Gordon as our subject for this week's Prior Center Profiles. I'm talking with Randy Dixon. Okay, so he considered it a part-time job. And that attitude, I guess, so the humbleness extended to almost everything in his life?
Well, that's what everyone I've talked to who knew him has told me. He was very unassuming, very humble, really quiet even. And, you know, you would think that, as Barnes said, he didn't come in the room like Audie Murphy. You know, he was just very unassuming and had kind of a quiet demeanor. But his appearance, as Ernie Dumas will say, begged to differ a little.
He looked like what he was. He, at the age of 60, he still looked like Charles Atlas, a kind of a bodybuilder. He was a big football star in college, and still at that age, he had broad shoulders and a slim waist, and carried himself like a Dallas Cowboy linebacker, but he was not a flashy guy at all.
He was not involved in controversy or anything like that, and I asked Steve Barnes how Nathan Gordon might be remembered politically.
In terms of Arkansas politics, what I suspect he'll be remembered for is one of the last, if not the last, lieutenant governor who truly treated the position as a part-time job. He saw absolutely no point in hanging around the Capitol when the legislature was not in session, when the Senate was not in session. He went home at the end of the day and at the end of the session. He did not use the office as a stepping stone. And to my knowledge, there was never a question of his personal character. There was no taint of scandal ever.
All right, we spent some time here talking about his role as lieutenant governor, but we're going to end with a much more personal story.
Well, this comes from his nephew, and he recalls shortly after he died, receiving a call from a man whose life he touched.
I got to the office one day and I had a call message that I didn't recognize the name and didn't say what it was about. I always tried to always return my calls and it was an out-of-state call. And so I called the number and this guy introduced himself by name and said, "Are you related to Nathan Gordon?" I said, "Yeah, it's my uncle, my law partner." He said, "Well," he said, "actually, I didn't see it. One of my children saw it. And I think USA Today has had a little blip in there. The Congressional Medal recipient had passed away." And he said, "And there's enough about the story, they recognize the facts." He said, "Let me tell you an interesting story. I was on that lab boat, last raft. Some of the guys in his raft were already deceased. And he said, you know, we knew we were going to get out of there. It was impossible." He watched the plane make first two rescues in the same bay. And said, you know, he said, every time they take off, we thought, well, they're not going to make it. He said, there's no way they can come back for us. They were well within range of fire. And he said, they came back. He said, I couldn't believe it. He said, they, long story short, they rescued all of them, including him, all the survivors. He was the Army, but of course, Nathan was Navy. And there wasn't a lot, you know, they didn't have emails and things like that back then, so, you know, news didn't get around. And they transferred him. He said, I'd been shot pretty badly. But they transferred him to a medical base and got him patched up, and he survived. He said, I never knew the name of the person that rescued me. He said, nobody ever told me. I never had any way of knowing. He said, I just want you to know. I put two and two together, and I saw the story, and I said, I'm in that story. I'm one of them. And he said, I just never got to tell anybody thank you. And boy, you know, it's pretty touching when you hear something like that. It brings it home.
Alan Gordon, the nephew of Nathan Gordon. This is that's a pretty powerful remembrance.
It really is, and it's too bad that he didn't get to talk to that man.
Yeah.
But, you know, there were 23 other guys on there on that plane that he did the same thing for.
Now, as you mentioned at the top of our conversation, we only had one audio clip from today's subject, Nathan Gordon, because the rest was silent film. If only there was a way that at least once in a while you and I could take advantage of video and show people these clips. If only there was a way.
Funny you should say. On March the 3rd at 6 o'clock, we will be doing a Zoom lecture. And it's called Arkansas News History, Exploring the KATV Collection. And we will be pulling some of our favorite and best clips that the video will lend more to it. And we'll be showing some of that from the collection. So I hope you'll go to the Pryor Center website and get the information, sign up, register, and join us on March the 3rd.
And we'll remind you a couple more times on KUAF between now and March 3rd. Don't worry.
Oh, good.
All right. Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. You can put Pryor Center into a search engine, find all sorts of things about Arkansas. Randy, until next week, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kyle.
What is chaos terrain? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science. And this is Scratching the Surface. Earth is not the only one that has some form of chaos, though on different planets and moons, chaos comes in the form of ridges, cracks, and jumbled masses of land. This is called chaos terrain. These terrains can be found on Mars, Mercury, Europa, and even Pluto. However, the specific causes of this weird jumbled up pieces of geology are still relatively unknown, especially since chaos terrain looks very different across the solar system. For example, Martian chaos terrain is believed to be tectonic collapse features when water came out of the surface, forming masses of blocks and jagged ridges and mesas that led into ancient river basins. There are also areas where ice may have sublimated in large volumes, also called galaxious chaos on Mars. By counting craters in these chaotic regions, it is estimated that the chaos terrain is about 2 to 3.8 billion years old. However, on Europa, impact events penetrate the surface and liquefy the crust, twisting and turning the water ice surface into chaotic terrains. Now, on Pluto, chaos terrains are muddled mountains and glaciers colliding together on the western shores of the Sputnik Planitia Basin. So who knows how this chaos terrain has really formed, but hopefully a lot of geologic areas in planetary science is still yet to be explored. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is produced in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas. You can find more episodes at KUAF.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Can you remember the first time you heard about QAnon? The vast, complicated, meandering conspiracy theory stretched from a deep online world on venues like 8chan to the very mainstream over just a few years. Images and messages directly inspired by the QAnon mythology can be seen among the rioters at the United States Capitol on January 6th. QAnon is not the first conspiracy theory to capture attention and devotion of millions of people. The attacks of September 11th, the assassination of President John Kennedy, the proposed dangers of some vaccines, even Stevie Wonder's blindness have inspired detailed conspiracy theories. Next semester, a signature seminar in the University of Arkansas Honors College will place a spotlight on conspiracy theories, their origins, and their potential effects. The course will be led by Ryan Neville Shepherd, an assistant professor of communications at the U of A. Tomorrow night, he'll deliver, via Zoom, a preview lecture of the seminar. The lecture is free, but does require registration. You can find a link at ozarksatlarge.com. We recently talked with him, via Zoom, about the lecture and the seminar. Ryan Neville Shepherd says conspiracy theories are anything but new.
Well, so there are some presidential scholars who suggest that even in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, there were some conspiracy arguments made, right? So that conspiracy culture is somewhat mainstream in politics in general, especially in a culture of accusation and blame. But I don't think that that's the same conspiracy culture that we've been witnessing lately. And I think that to understand modern conspiracy culture, we have to understand the growth of media. And mass media and what's happened to allow people to connect and to be anonymous and to say things that they don't have to be held accountable for, and then to connect with people who share extremist ideologies. I think that to trace conspiracy culture, we have to understand what television brought, especially to mainstream culture for conspiratorial genres. Think about the X-Files in the 1990s making that popular. I think that we have to look at early internet culture, and then I think more modern internet culture with social media, where it's a lot easier not only to create your own videos and post them to YouTube, but to connect with people so that you can play conspiratorial games like the people who follow QAnon.
Yeah, it, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, everybody knew that one person who, if you got cornered, might talk about the Trilateral Commission or something on the back of a $2 bill. But that was it. You didn't run in to those people that often. And it was hard to spread, you know, things about the Trilateral Commission. Now, it's everywhere. And you can only, if you desire, have as a source outlets that feed conspiratorial theories.
Well, I think from a media perspective, what we don't have anymore is we don't have gatekeepers. Mm. And we have immediate access to all the information that we want. And we have fragmentation in our media so that we're not just being exposed to the same media altogether, but we can pick and choose what we want to hear. So if I'm listening to podcasts, for instance, I can go down the rabbit hole and only choose conspiratorial podcasts. I can maybe decide that I don't want to watch mainstream news anymore, and I can get my news from very fringe sources on YouTube. And so it's a lot easier for people to access communities and to find their people and to spread that kind of misinformation so that you and I, Kyle, we see friends that we're on Facebook with spread this stuff in ways that we never would have before.
So how is that? What's done to combat that?
That's fascinating. And so I think that one of the best ways to understand how we're responding to conspiracy culture now is to understand InfoWars Alex Jones. And what was done to him probably about 2 or 3 years ago was that people recognized that he had a massive audience. But not only that he had a massive audience, he had appeal because he was making money off spreading conspiracy theories. So conspiracy theories are not only landing in a fertile climate, but they're pushed by conspiracy entrepreneurs, people who are spreading misinformation because they profit from it. And so when we recognized how some of the worst conspiracy entrepreneurs acted, some of our social media platforms deplatformed them to disrupt their business model. This made it far harder to reach large audiences and much easier to correct their information as it landed.
When you research the history of conspiracy theories, is it interesting to find out where they may have come from? You mentioned anti-vaxxers, and there was the article in what, the medical journal, The Lancet, that was later, disavowed, but that sort of gave folks a rise. And QAnon can get sort of traced back to what, the Pizzagate thing in Washington, D.C. Is it interesting to try to go back and find the origins of some of these?
Well, I think the origins start with the people who believe them, right? So I introduced the term a conspiracy entrepreneur, somebody who is the first to propose a counter-narrative that becomes popular. I think the 9/11 truth movement's a great example of that because they created Loose Change, a film that they thought was fictional, and then they kept adding more and more content and found a widespread following. It always starts with somebody who creates that message, but it has to find an audience that's receptive to the message. And that's going to come at very specific times. It's going to come at a time of major political polarization, especially when one party loses a lot of power and the other party comes into power. Typically, you'll see conspiracy theories peak at that moment. That's true for 9/11. That's true for the birther movement. And I think it's true for QAnon as well. And so there has to be that fertile climate for a conspiracy theory to evolve, but there also has to be somebody willing to provide that counter narrative to catch on.
With conspiracy entrepreneurship, you might have someone expanding this who doesn't necessarily believe it. I mean, when Alex Jones was under oath, I think it was a child custody case, said, oh, wait, I'm an entertainer. I don't really believe all the stuff that I say. Yet he still is able to sell this merchandise.
It's why conspiracy theories are dangerous. It's why we have to take them seriously, because they are forms of misinformation that people are creating, often to make a profit. And at first, it seems like it's just sort of funny that somebody's playing a game that seems goofy. But it has, as we've seen with the insurrection at the Capitol, dangerous ramifications. And so when we study conspiracy theories, we're trying to understand where they come from, who believes them, what their sort of characteristic patterns are, especially in as a form of counter-narrative. But we also want to understand how they transform society. And so they clearly transform what we believe to be true. They transform our attitudes, especially towards government and people who are authority figures. But they can also transform what we consider to be acceptable actions. And so the people who were storming the Capitol thought that what they were doing was ultimately right, that they were doing what, in their mind, they thought Trump was encouraging them to do and what QAnon was encouraging them to do. They were waiting for the storm. It never arrived.
I'm guessing that conspiracy theories are not a uniquely American phenomenon.
Absolutely not. And so I think 9/11 is a really interesting conspiracy theory because it obviously was popular in the United States, but it was even more popular outside the United States. So conspiracy theories typically take off when the person who's demonized in the conspiracy theory is already not well liked by a group of people. So when the United States has done things, especially with its military in certain parts of the world, it's obvious that people in certain parts of the world are going to think that we're capable of the great evil that's depicted in a conspiracy theory, especially if they don't like our military presence in the region. And so that's true for 9/11, especially throughout the Middle East. When you look at opinion polls that have tried to gauge how many people believe in that conspiracy theory, it's far more rampant, but you would expect that when people already don't approve of military actions by the United States.
Can real news fuel conspiracies? I think of something as benign as the Houston Astros
stealing signs, hitting, banging a trash can to get signs when a fastball is coming in. They win a World Series that year, all the way up to maybe church hierarchy redistributing, you know, members of their faith who were charged with pedophilia and not taking that seriously. When people see these news stories come out, can that fuel, you know, a sort of lean into other two conspiracies that are not true?
Well, I guess what I hear you asking is, are there real conspiracy theories out there that end up being proven true? And I think Watergate's a great example sure. of that. I think Watergate starts, it's a story about a sort of a secret government operation to spy on the other side. You know, there are other layers to that, but it sounds like fiction. And for a while, especially after there was constant denial from Nixon and the government, it was portrayed as a conspiracy theory that eventually became true, right? I think what official news sources face as a major problem is who to echo, to who provide a platform. I think Rudy Giuliani, by all means, at one point in his life, was a legitimate political figure, the mayor of New York City, America's mayor. But I think allowing him to talk about voter fraud week after week after week when he doesn't have any evidence, and then he puts people like Melissa Carone on to spread conspiracy theories about voter fraud in Michigan, at some point he has to be cut off. So we sometimes want to trust people who we think are legitimate sources, but we have to be able to recognize when they're spreading conspiracy theories and the mic needs to be turned off. Right now, I'm talking to you because we have a signature seminar, right, from the Honors College. We're going to be talking about sort of the growth of conspiracy culture from the 1950s forward. And so I think it's really important for a lot of people to understand where conspiracy theories come from, who believes them, how they spread, and how we respond. I think that this has become even more important lately because people who are in positions where they never expected to encounter conspiracy culture are now forced to respond. So who would have ever thought that people in charge of elections would have to defend their election results time and time again? So you may not think that you ever have to know anything about conspiracy culture and how to respond, but I think conspiracy culture is so rampant now that anybody can find themselves a character in a future conspiracy narrative. And so I think that's why it's important to understand it. But it's also important, especially if you are even a medical provider, to know how to respond so you can try to correct the misinformation that's had a devastating impact on our community.
Ryan Neville Shepherd is an assistant professor of communications at the University of Arkansas. He'll deliver a preview lecture of his U of A Honors College seminar, Conspiracy Theories, tomorrow night at 5:15 via Zoom. It's free. You do need to register. You can find a link at ozarksatlarge.com. You can find out more about his lecture and other Honors College matters by going to honorscollege.uark.edu. He spoke with us recently via Zoom. This is Ozarks at Large. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Snow. Okay, Snow and Marion County, probably out of our broadcast range, but it seemed fitting. They can listen online, of course. Timothy Dennis produced our show from his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. Contributors today included Zuzanna Sitek. Scratching the Surface is written and hosted by Dr. Caitlin Ahrens, produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Our thanks to Randy Dixon with the Pryor Center for his help again this Monday. Thank you for listening. Please stay warm and stay safe. Ozarks at Large, a production of 91.3 KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums, back with you. Brand new show tomorrow at noon and 7.